Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the case of the Bat Boogeyman. We're pleased to be joined by Alison Peel. Alison has a PhD in veterinary epidemiology and population genetics from the University of Cambridge and is currently a postdoctoral research fellow at the Environmental Futures Research Institute at Griffith University in Brisbane. So thanks for joining us and thanks for coming on the podcast, Alison. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Pleased to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. So let's dig into a little bit about how you got to where you are today, what your journey was like, what interested you as a child. What does epidemiology mean? What does population genetics mean? And what is a postdoctoral research fellow, and kind of little bits about your work. Just tell us about yourself.
Sure. That's a lot of questions. I'll try and work my way through. Basically, I've always had an interest in animals growing up. I grew up in a pretty bushy area of Sydney and had lots of wildlife around, lots of catching lizards in the garden and things like that, birds and kookaburras around. And when I got a cat when I was about 3 years old, decided I wanted to be a vet then, apparently, and was fortunate enough to be able to follow through with that. So I trained as a vet and worked in practice for a while, but always had that interest in wildlife and was keen to get back involved in that. And the way that I approached that was through research. So I've been very interested in moving on from a clinical veterinary role where you look at disease in individual animals and animal health, and moving on to more of a population level study of animal health and animal disease. So epidemiology is essentially the study of diseases across populations and the risk factors that lead to those diseases in particular individuals. And again, population genetics is, again, moving on from the genetics or the genetic makeup or predispositions of any individual animals, but instead looking at it at a population level and trying to understand what the genetics of each individual within the population can tell us about the population as a whole and where they came from and how they mix together.
So what kind of animals do you work with at the moment?
I focus almost exclusively on flying foxes, which is a colloquial term for fruit bats in Australia and Asia. They're very large fruit bats, yeah.
So I think we're obviously big bat fans here, and so it's great that you're helping to work with our bat friends. But so I think in a lot of people's minds, the idea of a bat, it's a singular thing, and it's one bat animal, and maybe a kind of back of the mind appreciation that there's probably a variety of species. But what kind of variation and how many species are there across the bat umbrella, if you will?
Yeah, well, they're a really, really varied order of mammals, and they can be divided sometimes into what we might call microbats and megabats. And microbats are the smaller bats that tend to be sort of eating insects or other small animals. And then we have the megabats, which include the fruit bats, which tend to feed on nectar or fruit and things like that. And there's a huge diversity. There's actually well over 1,200 or even 1,300 different species of bats. So they represent quite a lot of mammals across the world.
And so is the microbat, megabat split one purely based on size, or what kind of factors are at play there?
No, it's a little bit of a contentious issue, and I'm not fully up to date on all the taxonomy, but no, there's the size is sort of a convenient general clustering, but there's a lot more genetic factors and things like diet and where they live and how the different species evolved. One major difference, which is not a nice clean split, but most of the microbats will echolocate, so they use their internal sonar mechanism to help them find their way around their environment and also detect their prey that they're eating, whereas most of the megabats don't use that ability and rely more on sight and smell.
And is it that the echolocation ability is not present in the megabats, or it's just they don't need it because of their environments they live in?
It seems in most cases that it hasn't developed. There are a couple of megabats that have developed it independently, so it's obviously a pretty good thing to, you know, there's a strong selection for it if evolved a couple of times independently in both the Mega and the Microbats, but that's only happened a couple of times, and so in most cases they've just found alternative ways to find their food.
Hey, so I love the word Megabat so much I'm going to keep trying to use it as much as possible. So the Megabat of the flying fox, which is where you work, paint us a picture of what a flying fox looks like. What kind of size? Where do they live?
Okay, so there's four different flying fox species in Australia, and the smallest is the little red flying fox, which is really quite widespread across Australia, and that's probably they're about sort of 400 or 500 grams, probably the size of maybe a guinea pig, but they range up to the spectacled flying fox, the black flying fox, and the grey-headed flying fox, which are all very similar in size, and they're much larger, so they can be up to a kilogram in size, so with a wingspan almost as long as your arm. So they live typically in native forests, in quite big colonies or roosts, we call them, in populations. So they're quite a social animal. Those roosts can vary in size from a couple of 100 individuals, or if there is a good flowering event in the area which they're feeding on, it might be in the many tens of thousands. So they communicate with each other through means that we really don't understand at this stage, but somehow they manage to find these big flowering events that they produce good food for them, and an area can go from having very few flying foxes to, yeah, many tens of thousands of flying foxes over a very short period of time.
Wow. So you have no idea how that happens. Like, so how could something, you say, can go from very small area of flying foxes to tens of thousands very quickly? Do you have any idea on the geographical spread where those may come from? Like, how far away would those additional foxes that come in come from?
It could be up to, you know, 1,000 kilometres or further. I mean, there have been examples in New South Wales, in Australia, in the southern part of New South Wales, where we have very big eucalypt flowering events. And it's been estimated sometimes that you know, more than half of the state's population of flying foxes has turned up at this one colony for this particular flowering event. So that's, you know, well over 1,000 kilometres that these bats may have been coming from. So how that information, you know, either is spread around through the bats, or how they detect that, whether it's through smell, is, yeah, still pretty unknown.
Now it's time to dive into your story. And before we do our stories, we like to ask our guests if they have chosen a Batman actor that they would like to represent their Batman in their story. So have you managed to choose anybody?
Well, I think it's probably more fitting that I go for a Batgirl actress or actor. And Alicia Silverstone is the chosen actor today.
Brilliant. That's our first Alicia Silverstone. So it's a great choice. Thanks very much. Outbreaks of a rare virus in rural Australia are causing death and disease. The people are scared, and in that fear, look to personify it and aim squarely at the boogeyman of the local bat population. The demonisation turns to anger, which turns to action as bats are hunted and their habitat further destroyed. News reaches Bruce Wayne, who knows all too well what a deep fear of bats can do. He decides to help, and turning the full philanthropic might of the Wayne Foundation to the problem, starts to enact a plan. Okay, Alison, so tell us a little bit about what's going on here. So I'm guessing, well, let's start first with the environment and the deforestation and things like that, and the hunting. So is deforestation, or like the reduction of environments of bats, a big problem? What kind of problems does it cause? Are these bats hunted? Are they hunted for food? Are they hunted out of fear?
Yeah, so we think that that the environmental change in Australia is causing big problems for the bats here in Australia, for the flying foxes in Australia. And over the last, well, I guess since Australia was colonised, we've seen a lot of native forests cleared, particularly around the coastal areas of Australia. and particularly those areas that have trees that flower during winter time. Now, these flying foxes rely on pollen and nectar from eucalypts and flowering native species. And the way that these species flower in Australia is that it's really irregular. Some species will flower at certain times of the year and other species that will flower at other times of the year. And over the course of a year, there tends to be more or less a constant supply of food. But one period of time in particular that tends to be a little bit lean with not too much food around is winter time. And we found that the areas that have mainly been cleared for housing or for agriculture in coastal Australia have particularly been in those areas that have winter flowering trees. And so that we find that for the flying foxes during winter time, they're experiencing food shortages where they just really can't find enough food to feed on. As a result, we have seen an increasing pattern where flying foxes are coming into urban areas more and more. As those urban areas develop and people plant their gardens, planting either native species or fruit trees or other fruiting trees, those bats are using those as alternative sources of food as their native foods are gradually dwindling. And what we've also seen in combination with this is with climatic cycles, that we have particular years that follow a particular climate cycle in the El Niño and La Niña pattern, where if we have a lot of rain after a long dry period, that the eucalypt trees go into a growth phase. They sort of use that rain to grow rather than producing flowers. And as a result, because they're growing and not producing flowers, it can produce very widespread food shortages at any time of the year, really, for these flying foxes. And these flying foxes then have to travel very far and wide to try and find sources of food in these acute food shortages. This is something that has always happened over, decades and millennia, probably. But what we're finding recently is that at the end of those periods, when the trees do start flowering again, that instead of going back to their nomadic behaviours and moving across the landscape, that these bats are staying in urban areas and in very fragmented populations. And we really think that is an indication of a general poor health of the population of the bats.
Right. So I think in a lot of people's minds, you have this kind of bat association with, they can be quite a scary thing, and especially if you're in an urban environment and you've not really had the bats coming into your urban environment before, if you've lived there a while, and now suddenly because of this inability to find food they're coming in. What kind of reactions do you tend to see from people in areas where there hasn't been a high bat presence, and then suddenly that starts to happen more and more?
Yeah, well, I think it can be quite varied. I mean, it's interesting that you pick up on the negative associations of bats. I mean, certainly those kind of images are out there, but there's a lot of people that feel very positive about bats. And as I mentioned, if you can get an up close look at them, and particularly the little bat babies, they're very, very cute. Their faces are very cute. So it's often the case that if people have never seen a bat close up, they do have that sort of fear association. And as bats are coming into urban areas, again, if they just hear them or see them at a distance, they might be scared. If they actually take the opportunity to have a closer look at them, get a pair of binoculars and have a look at their face and watch them in the roost, we actually find that people's opinion often change, and they're quite happy to have them around their area.
And so is any of your work to do with kind of bat PR in a way, like, and about changing misconceptions? What do you do around that, and how have you found that kind of landing?
Yeah, that's a very new area of the work that I'm involved in anyway. I have some of my the collaborators that I work with have been involved in that area for longer, but what we are trying to understand is how people talk about bats and their feelings towards bats, their feelings towards some of the diseases that they may carry, and how they communicate those feelings amongst their peers and with other people. And generally with humans, we find that's done through narratives or stories. And often within stories, there's a hero and a villain and a range of other characters. And And we're trying to understand the different stories that people tell about bats and the risks associated with them. And by understanding those stories and then being able to include our scientific knowledge within those stories, we're hoping to be able to better inform people about some of the sort of background knowledge and the things that we're learning.
So what would you say, in your opinion, is the biggest misconception about bats that you would like to change?
Certainly within Australia, there's a preconception that bats are pests and increasing in numbers to kind of, you know, to vermin or pest status within urban areas. And this is a really big misconception. What we're finding is that the numbers of bats in Australia are not increasing. In fact, some species are actually declining quite rapidly. But instead, what we're seeing is that those bats are moving into urban areas and in smaller, much more fragmented populations. And so the number of people with bats living nearby them may be increasing. And so people are perceiving this as a sort of an explosion in bat numbers when, in fact, it's just a proximity thing. And in many cases, the bat numbers are actually declining. So the other misconception, which is a really big one, is that they don't really serve any purpose and we should just get rid of them if they're causing trouble. But in fact, these species of bats are really crucial to maintaining our forests. And if we want forests in Australia, native eucalyptic forests, then we need to have bats to pollinate the trees across the large areas that we have here in Australia. And that's our experience here in Australia, but it's also the case globally with fruit bats who are a pollinating species, and that's the case in Asia and in Africa and across a large number of different species.
So looking back to the story, let's talk about viruses and diseases. So there's been an outbreak in this particular story, an outbreak of unknown origin that's been pinned on the bats due to the bats kind of coming into these more populated areas due to their deforestation and things like that. How dangerous are bats in that sense of viruses and diseases? Is this a fair accusation?
So there certainly have been over the last couple of decades a number of viruses that have been detected in bats which can be quite fatal in human and other animals. So they have received a lot of attention because of that. And so there's always that question when there's a new virus that emerges that maybe is affecting human or people, that wildlife, you know, a range of different species are worth looking at, and bats in particular are often a focus in if they're in that area. And so it's certainly reasonable to look. A lot of the misconceptions come around the levels of risk in terms of the exposure, and so for many of the viruses that we study in bats, the period of time that the bats are able to pass on that virus to another animal are very short, and the likelihood of that happening is exceedingly low. So it's one of these situations where it's generally a exceedingly low risk situation, but the consequences can be quite high.
So I guess now if we could look to how Bruce can help. So Bruce has the Wayne Foundation, which is a big philanthropic organisation. He's a big fan of bats, and he doesn't want them to be unfairly hunted and things like that. So what could he do, and in turn, what can we do to help these bats and to help their environment and to help them get along?
Well, we really feel with the research that we're doing at the moment that one of the primary drivers of viral spillover, we call it, or transmission from bats into other animals, comes from these bats that are forming these very fragmented and urban roosts. And as I mentioned, we think that the reason that is occurring is because of loss of native habitat. So we believe with our research, and it's something that we're trying to achieve, and having Bruce Wayne on board to help us out would be very helpful indeed, to basically try and work out which of the key species of trees that the bats are missing and where are they most needed, and basically just plant trees in areas of need to try and attract the bats back out of those urban areas. If we can set up a network of these flowering trees again, we expect that the bats will reinitiate more of their natural migration tendencies and their nomadic movements, rather than staying put in the urban areas where they're more likely to cause conflict with people.
And does that rely on you making any breakthroughs in the bat communication stuff that we were talking about earlier on, or is it more about identifying the right tree species?
It's a combination of both. I mean, I think the areas of landscape that need planting, they can't be done by a single person or a single group alone. And as much as Bruce Wayne can help us out with some money, we really need people power to cover large areas of both government land but also privately owned land to plant these trees that in the more rural areas that will attract the bats away from the urban areas. And so by getting the message out to members of the public and encouraging people to see the value in planting these trees on their properties is a really big part of it. And also for the support from the government, it depends a lot on the general populace and how they feel about bats and how much support they would give for this kind of initiative. And I think both for Bruce Wayne's efforts and for anyone else's efforts, the more people that are on board and see the value of bats, the better.
That's all for now. So with the help of the Wayne Foundation and with as many supporters as possible, the bats can hopefully have a brighter future. And so thanks to Alison for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. I've had a really good time.
If you want to find out more about Alison's work, you can look at bat1health.org. That link will be in the description. Or you can follow Alison on Twitter at ali_bat. Again, link in the description. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.